We've got Pooh-powered data centers, augmented reality, and a Microsoft Windows extravaganza. Twite on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, Episode 20, recorded November 26, 2012. Pooh over IP. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by Social Media Solutions from SAP. If you're a social media manager at a large enterprise, gain insight and engage in social media in a systematic way with Social Media Solutions from SAP. Learn more at sap.com/twit. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone to get a second one free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by a fantastic all-star, rock-star panel of geeks, technologists, and all-around badasses. Starting with the number one badass, Mr. Brian Chi, the Thin Links Evangelist from Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how you doing? You're back in Hawaii now?
Yeah, I feel a little folded and spindled after an 11-hour flight, but hey, that's all right. Yeah. It was fun visiting D.C. and Gainesville.
You know, most people, when they go on vacation, they go to a place like Hawaii. You went to D.C.? I don't really understand that, but that's okay. I mean, it's part of your mystique as the geek in paradise. Now, right next to you is another one of our longtime guests, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis from Enterprise Efficiency down in Orlando, Florida. You were also on the Brian Chi worldwide tour, were you not?
Absolutely. We were happy to host Brian and his lovely wife here in Florida, had a great time, and managed to remain unindicted throughout the entire process. So we'll call it a success.
Fantastic. And finally, rounding out our panel is, a person that we've wanted to have on the show many a time, but it sometimes just didn't quite work out, so I'm so happy that she's here, Miss Mary Jo Foley from All About Microsoft. Mary Jo, thank you for coming back.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me back.
We didn't scare you off last time?
No.
Okay, well, the reason why we've got you here is because we're doing a Microsoft extravaganza. But before we get to that, let's cover a little bit of the Enterprise Byte. Starting off with, the cost of powering the internet. There's a great infographic here that describes exactly what goes into creating the internet that you and I use. It's about 30 billion watts, 1.5% of the world's energy output, which doesn't sound like a lot until you realize that's about 30 nuclear power plants. We also know that 10% of that power is used for the actual processing and the actual sending of packets through switches and routers. The remaining 90% is what you could consider waste energy usage. It's for the cooling systems and the like, lighting. So anything you can do to make a data center more efficient, well, you're talking about some serious, serious cost savings. Now, the first player in green data centers has to be Google. We covered a little bit about this story a while back. I think it was episode 4 of Twyatt when we talked about Google's top secret data centers. Essentially, they had figured out a way to put everything into servers and into racks that they needed and leave out all the stuff that they didn't. They did things like keeping the hot aisle at 80 of the cool aisle at 80 degrees rather than that frigid 40 degree that you might see in a typical data center, and letting the hot aisle get up to 120 degrees, which meant that they didn't have to use expensive chillers. They could just use evaporative towers, which means they greatly reduced the amount of energy they spent on heat removal. And they could also do things like run DC in the data center and run battery backups next to the servers so they could avoid having huge racks of UPSs. Chibert, you do a lot of work with data centers. Do you see this being a trend, people trying to find ways of just pulling every last bit of energy savings out of their data setup?
A lot of it's, the University of Hawaii is taking a really hard look at trying to make it more efficient. And we've actually had a mandate that over, an 8-year period, we have to reduce our energy consumption by 50%. So one of the things that's happened is we're trying to get people to pull their servers out of department offices so we can shut classroom buildings down on weekends and evenings. So, yes, there's a huge movement. Lots of people are asking, can we go to D.C.? Can we go to condenser water instead of chill water? Because condenser water is actually the waste product of chill water, which my air conditioning engineer says, I can give you condenser water all day long. So I'm going to try and see if we can hold them to it.
Curtis, I want to throw this over to you because you deal a lot with a lot of these issues at enterprise efficiency. And that is, this seems like a no-brainer, right? I mean, of course companies are going to want to extract every bit of energy savings. Of course they're going to want to save money. But they haven't, and they haven't in the past because of what? What has been the holdup from them trying to take the steps that Google is taking?
Well, it has in the past come down to cost. I mean, it does require an investment in order to be able to either upgrade your infrastructure to the latest technology or to design the most effective way of doing things. Let's face it, for a long time, especially in North America, electricity was pretty cheap. And there are places where that's still true. But what we're finding is that as data centers use more and more of the stuff, even something that is inexpensive on a per unit basis, if you buy enough units, becomes expensive. And that's why we're seeing things like an emphasis on ambient air cooling for servers, citing data centers in places where ambient heating and cooling is possible. We're seeing a lot more interest in presenting a green face to not only the general public, but to our shareholders. And so I think we're going to see an entire new generation in data centers coming online from the last 3 or 4 years through the next decade.
Right. Chibert, back to you. When we talk about the cycle of taking chill water and cooling off your data center, of running your hot and your cold aisles properly, what challenges do you have in a traditional data center that, you basically have to overhaul it in order to make it work the way that Google's making it work?
Well, one of the issues is most people have all their racks facing in the same direction. So when I did the Pimp Your Data Center article for InfoWorld several years back, one of the things we had to do was spin every other row of racks so that all the hot air stayed together and all the cold air stayed together. And then we took freezer slats and draped it over the racks and in front of the aisles so that we could keep the hot and cold air from mixing. That alone dropped our energy consumption in half for one of our data centers. It's pretty amazing what you can do with just a little bit of effort.
Mary Jo, I want to throw it over to you because we're talking about Google now, and Google has had the buzz on data centers for quite a while, but they're not the only player in green data. In fact, I believe Microsoft has made some pretty long strides recently in getting every last bit of energy savings out of their data centers and making them carbon neutral. Do you know anything about that story?
I do. Microsoft just recently started talking about this again. They have this prototype data center idea for Cheyenne, Wyoming, that they're calling the data plant. And what they're going to do there is recycle common waste byproducts to power the data center. And they're using something called the stationary fuel cell from Fuel Cell Energy as part of this design. And it's still in the R&D phase right now. But I think in early December, they're putting this up to a vote as to whether it goes forward and how it's going to go forward. So they've been doing a lot of research, not just now, but over the years, about how to make themselves more efficient in their data centers, because they have just as many data centers as Google does.
Right. And who is that? Nikki in the chat room wants to know if it's Cheyenne cattle. Yes, actually it is. It's basically poop over IP. It's taking waste products and turning it into power in a way that is very carbon neutral. Now, I also want to throw over to Curtis here. I remember you once on an enterprise efficiency program speaking about locations for data centers, specifically talking about locations that were very favorable for energy and cooling efficiencies within a data center. In other words, places that are cold and have access to renewable energy sources like geothermal. Do you remember when you were talking about that? What are the locations around the world that are more popular for that kind of data co-location?
Well, interestingly enough, one of the places that surprised me when I was told about companies locating there was Las Vegas, Nevada, because as it turns out, they have a mean temperature of 70 degrees or below for the vast majority of the year. Sure, it gets very hot for some time during the daylight hours during a portion of the year, but it cools off pretty quickly. And for the evenings and then for the rest of the year, they're able to use ambient cooling. We're also seeing people using the renewable energy sources in places like Iceland. Iceland has become fairly popular for siting large data centers. I know that that is something that Scotland is looking at. You know, Scotland has committed itself to being a 100% renewable energy nation within the next 20 years. And they're certainly looking at being the location of large data centers because of the attraction of the renewable energy. So essentially what you're looking for is temperate zones. You're looking for geological stability. Earthquakes are bad. And what we're finding is that there are a lot of places in moderate-sized cities, in nations that don't have other large existing industrial bases, where we're going to see more and more data centers cropping up, especially since with the advent of new transatlantic cables or transoceanic cables, we're finding that siting the data centers is not dependent on data access, but on energy access.
Fantastic. One last bit on this data center kick. It's not exactly energy efficiency, but it does involve big data centers and big colos. And that is the software-defined network. Again, Google is known for doing this. They're using OpenFlow. We did run a story on Twiit not too long ago about these Pluto switches, these very interesting boxes that were misrouted to a small shop in the Midwest. And they found out that Google had been making their own switches, their own boxes, their own silicon, their own interfaces, and getting up to 40 gigabits per second synchronous communications that they were using inside their data centers. But that's all being run by software-defined networking. Chiebert, first tell me, what is software-defined networking?
It's all about being able to, through a high-level programming language, instead of having to get down into C or assembler, you're able to describe protocols, you're able to describe handshaking in a high-level language. And the whole idea is, as new developments come out, you want to be able to very quickly swap them out. It's all part of this whole concept that went back to Carnegie Mellon on building block networks, research that was done by Eduardo Biagioni, who happens to be one of the authors of the original ATM NNI inter-switch signaling specification. Software-defined networks also means that we have less of a dependency upon the core network, less of a dependency upon brand X versus brand Y. So with this layer of abstraction, you can start having this disassociation with having to go with a single vendor, which is come and bit a lot of people in the behind over the years.
Right. My understanding is that essentially we're separating the control channel from the data channel so that you've got a dedicated control channel. It routes the traffic for you, and the data channel, which are the switches, it's the actual hardware, only has to worry about making the millions and billions of computations every second to get a packet to where it's going. This is not on the dock, but I just realized, have any of you heard about the YFox story coming out of, I can't remember, I'm sorry, some university research center? Not yet?
Nope. I have not.
Okay. So yeah. They're promising crazy increases in wireless transfer, essentially by separating the data channel from the control channel and allowing a control channel to act as the traffic cop for wireless RF. It strikes me that this seems to be where we're heading. As we head to more and more dense data centers, we're finding that it's easier to have a dedicated control channel that that then becomes the traffic cop for either your wireless or your wired packets. Mary Jo, there was also a story about Microsoft's use of SDN. It struck me because it sounded almost as if Google was getting all the press from using OpenFlow, and Microsoft sort of threw up their hands and said, wait, we're doing this as well. Did you hear anything about their SDN efforts at, say, the Build conference or beforehand?
Yeah, before that, actually, I think they were doing this in response to VMware as much as anything else. They did do a blog post that you're talking about, Padre, that where they said, hey, we're in SDN too, and we want to more broadly define this than just managing network endpoints. We want to bring in Hyper-V and the new Hyper-V extensible switch technology that we have, system center. So they're trying to broaden the definition and say, we want to do, we have a whole suite of products that basically can let admins manage and create virtual networks that run on top of physical networks, that we can create policies that go across these physical and virtual networks. So they're kind of taking what they already have and repackaging it and saying, hey, we have what you guys are calling SDN as well, but we just have it with our existing products. And they, because of our emphasis on management through System Center, we can do a lot of what everybody else is acting is like some big new discovery.
Curtis, I want to give you the last word on the data center discussion. And that is, I get excited by data center technology. So do you and Chibert and Mary Jo. But why should the average user care about what's going on in the data center, in that place where his data is stored, but it's out of sight, out of mind? Why is this important to pretty much everyone?
Well, I think that one of the big reasons that data centers are important to everyone is the same reason that power plants are important to everyone. You may not live near a power plant, but the rate that you pay for the electricity that you use is dependent upon how efficient the power generating facilities that your utility has are, among other things. And that's becoming more and more true as computing services become commodities. If we think of data centers as being the power generating plants of the cloud or the internet, the analogy works really well. And in the same way that we tend to pay attention when a utility wants to build a large new generating facility, we're going to pay attention when a company wants to build a new data center, because if they're able to wring the last bit of efficiency out of that, ultimately it bubbles down to our costs, keeping our costs for computing services and processes as low as possible.
Well, let's make a pledge right now that we're going to come back and we're going to do a big data center episode. I think we just have to have a sit down and a shootout, invite a bunch of experts in, and just go for our choices for making the best data center possible. In fact, we might be doing that around the time of Interop. Now, you know, when we think about communications, we often sort of default to technology. I mean, I'm a big fan of technology. I love technology. I believe in the promise of technology. I use it to podcast, to communicate. But what happens when you don't have that face-to-face element? I mean, when you can't actually see the person that you're talking to? What happens when you can't look someone in the eye and figure out from their facial expressions or their gestures what they're thinking? Well, that's when technology just kind of falls apart. And that's when we need a little extra help. That's when we need GoToMeeting, GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix. You see, these days it's well known that nonverbal communication says far more than our words. Our gestures, body movement, and subtle cues help us to communicate and get things done. Now, if our teams or our colleagues are in different buildings, different cities, different countries, we have very limited options. We could use an audio-only conference call and forsake all nonverbal communication. We could demand that our teams or our clients and colleagues come together, robbing them of precious time and resources. Or we could use GoToMeeting with HD Faces, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate online. I do another podcast called The Book Guys with Paul Alvis, and it's a fun endeavor. We love doing it, but we always had this problem using another product, and that was the audio was always not right, or the video wasn't right, or we weren't syncing properly, or we couldn't share our documents. We had people using iPads and Macs and PCs, and it was always a mess. GoToMeeting with HD Faces from Citrix fixed all of that. You see, what we were able to do is to have a single interface that allowed us to schedule the meeting, to send email invitations to everyone in the call, to allow people to either call in or connect via computer, via a very easy-to-install client, to use their iPads, to use their mobile devices, to use their PCs and their Macs, and have everything be one seamless interface. GoToMeeting with HD Faces made this podcast not just easier to do, but far more productive. When we could see what we were looking at, when we could share documents, when we could tell from people's facial expressions if they were getting what we were saying, it just made everything better. And that's what I think it'll do for you. This is what I want you to do. I want you to visit GoToMeeting. I want you to try them free for 30 days. Don't wait. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Remember to use the promo code ENTERPRISE, and we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's head right back into the news. This time we've got something that's a little bit more on the fun side, Microsoft Augmented Reality. Curtis, what do you know about Microsoft AR?
I actually know relatively little. I think that what they are doing is validating the concept of AR, the notion of using them for live events is, I think, one of those targeted things that Microsoft does so very well. Rather than coming in with their first venture into AR being the all-encompassing, wear our augmented reality glasses everywhere, choose a venue, start small, they'll iterate on it, and ultimately they'll end up with the product that they're happy with.
Very well said. I think actually what you said encapsulates what a lot of people automatically think of when they hear Microsoft's AR glasses. And they're thinking of Google glasses, the Google virtual reality glasses that we've kind of seen, we've kind of had demos of. I actually have a pre-order in for them, but I haven't heard anything about it. Google took a different tact. They said, this is really cool tech, and we're going to figure out what to do with it. I think you're right in saying Microsoft took the reverse tact. They said, here's something where it would be useful. A sporting event, say a baseball game or a football game or a hockey event where you could actually get stats, real-time stats popping up. Now that we've got a use, we can design the hardware around it. Mary Jo, is this really big on Microsoft's plate? I mean, are they investing significantly in this, or is this one of these things that comes out of the garage and it may or may not fail?
You know what's funny about this story is, I don't know if you guys remember this, but around June of this year, a big Microsoft PowerPoint document leaked that was basically their whole game plan for the next Kinect, the Kinect 2 as it's called, and the Xbox 720. And part of that part of that deck, which Microsoft had its lawyers sick on all different websites to pull down, which makes you believe it's a real deck, was this whole thing that is codenamed Fortaleza, which are the Kinect glasses. And there was even a date in that deck for these as 2014. They come out after the next Xbox. So I think this isn't just something that they're playing around with as an R&D project. I think they're already beyond that point, and it's already something they're building and designing, maybe even the Surface team, who knows, since they're the team at Microsoft building all the new cool hardware. So I think this is coming for sure. And I think it's about a year plus away.
Interesting. Yeah. What I like about this is Microsoft's announcement even though it's not getting all the press of Google's announcement, it seems to be much more of, yeah, this is coming, not we're developing it. It's we know it works. We've got the technology. We've even got a use case for it. We just have to figure a way to bring it to market. Cheever, I know you've been chomping at the bit to get your hands on some Google glasses. What do you feel about Microsoft's AR efforts?
Actually, what's going to be really cool about those is it's for the first time going to bring augmented reality down to the consumer level. Now, what a lot of people keep missing is that there has been military applications of augmented reality for a very, very long time. You know, when it started getting into those monocles that they used on the Apache platform, there has been augmented reality glasses. They look like lab glasses that have been available for the special forces and various other people for a very long time, but they're expensive. Now, the advantage Microsoft has is all of these systems so far have been Windows-based. Windows has an amazingly rich set of APIs and SDKs for this kind of thing. I dealt a lot with them when we were doing research on Kilauea Crater. We were actually using some augmented reality, some real basic stuff, to overlay things like temperature of the ground over a picture of the crater. We wanted to go a lot further, and scientists have wanted this forever and ever, but it's just been too freaking expensive. This has got a lot of people in the science community very excited.
I do want to. I could not find the video for the life of me. They may have taken it down, but there was a company at Interop Las Vegas that was showing off their own AR glasses, and it wasn't a Google Glass. It wasn't a Microsoft product, but I think it was based on the same idea. And the idea was it was designed for data centers, and you could walk into one of those cavernous data centers. And as we all know, nobody likes labeling their stuff. They don't want people to know where they are. They don't want them to know what they're using. But what the glasses would do is, at a glance, they could show which racks were yours. They would show you exactly what pieces of equipment were in there. And if you enabled it, it would give you the usernames and passwords so that you could service that gear. Very cool idea. But, you know, it was one of these things that we all kind of looked at each other and said, there's no way this is going to happen within the next decade. If Microsoft is doing this, I mean, what were you saying, Cheever?
I was going to say Boeing's already doing it. All the wire harnesses for the Boeing products have been with augmented reality glasses. So instead of having to have these giant templates and they create these cable harnesses, they've been using AR glasses to show exactly where things are supposed to be. So it's been in use for quite a while.
That's right. That's right. Actually, now that you mention it, I remember seeing they had this jig and they had these glasses so that you could look around and see where a component went and place it in the jig without the underlying structure. It allowed them to basically speed up production. So, yeah, this is something that I think we've been using a lot in the industrial sector. Hopefully it makes it down to the consumer. Any last words on AR or augmented reality technologies? Okay, then we're moving on. This next story, I didn't really know how to place it within the enterprise sphere, but I know it belongs there. This was about a child who was suspended, was sent home from school because she refused to wear an RFID tag. Now, there are all sorts of really thorny issues about privacy and about what are your expectations of privacy on a public campus. I don't want to get into that so much as I want to talk about how this is basically a continuation of the big data story. When we talk about big data, we talk about gathering as much information as possible. Every data point, every sensor, every bit of information helps us build big data models. Well, in this particular case, we've got a student who doesn't want to be tracked, doesn't want to have to wear this thing, doesn't want to let a network know where she is. But, I mean, really, we already have that, right? I mean, I'm thinking about Interop. We were tracking attendees via the Wi-Fi beacons on their iPhones, or we could track the IMEI numbers on their cell phones. All that data is already within the network. Should we really be worried about having an extra piece of gear that can be tracked? Or is it, by this point, are we just sort of throwing up our hands and saying, yeah, I'm going to be tracked. I'm just going to have to live with it. Curtis, let me throw it over to you first. What do you think? Is this a grand invasion of privacy, or is this just the way that we're going to be moving as we get more and more data sets?
Well, I think that as long as the tracking is only happening within the school, then it's not nearly the privacy issue that some people would make out. Most public schools that I'm aware of today, students already have to wear a school-issued ID badge, in the same way that teachers and volunteers do, so that security people, that staff members, can very quickly tell at a glance whether someone is authorized to be on the property. Having the RFID tracking doesn't add that much, in my mind, to the privacy concern, may add somewhat to the ability to track students, take attendance, do things like that. So I'm not troubled by it within the confines of the school. I am much more troubled, to be brutally honest, by the push by some schools to try and control what students do outside the school walls. I think that gets into a different issue. This one bothers me very little.
Mary Jo, what about you? I mean, aside from privacy concerns, is this a data set that is actually useful in some way, shape, or form to know where people are, to know what they're doing in something enclosed like a campus?
Yeah. I think I've kind of given up all hope of privacy and any image or appearance of it. And you know what really brought that home to me? I actually bought over the weekend my Windows Phone 8. I don't know. We'll tip it back so you can see it. It's the HTC 8X, and I got the Nokia device. Verizon. I said Nokia. but when I was setting this up, I couldn't believe how many different prompts I was getting for all the different applications I was installing for Microsoft and other people. You know, by the way, we're tracking your privacy. Like, are you acknowledging this? You're going to let us look at where you are? Is this okay? So I feel like the tech companies now are telling you, hey, by the way, you have to agree to this for us to do this. But people are just kind of blindly going, yeah, of course, okay. And it's funny to me that people then say, wait, I don't want people tracking me, when how easy we are making it for them to track us. So I guess I just see it as, yep, if you're in the tech world these days, you've given up your privacy. And even if you don't think you have, you have.
That's actually a great point. I think in the early days of these mobile devices that were location aware, one of the rallying cries that you heard often from the consumer base was, look, if you're going to do this, just let us know. You know, we want to be able to opt out. We want to be able to opt in. It sounds to me like most people now, even though they're being warned, they just sort of click through. It's like, yeah, I know you know where I am. Fine. You're not going to do anything bad with it. Chibert, do you think we've turned the corner? Do you think people are becoming less, well, sensitive about having their location tracked now that they know that it's sort of part and parcel of having a mobile device?
Well, you know, when I was when Kurt was going to go and pick me up from the bus station, I actually was wanting a glimpse so that he could see my path through from Jacksonville to Gainesville. But I opted in for that. Now, if I had something like that running all the time and it was publicly available, that's kind of creepy. Don't like that. However, I'm going to take a little bit of the other side. Knowing where all the students are at any time during the school day is actually a big safety issue, especially when you have school lockdowns. Being able to count those noses very quickly electronically and say, no, we've got a kid trapped, you know, locked in, you know, storage closet X, go get them before the school burns down. That's a really big safety issue. And I like that. Now, as long as nobody goes and abuses it, I still think it's a good thing.
Yeah, let me go back to you on that, Mary Jo, because what Chibert's talking about is the promise of location-aware tech and the promise of these big data sets. If we can use that data to, okay, let's get really extreme, to save lives in a worst-case scenario, is it worth it? I mean, should people look at this not as an attempt to intrude upon their privacy, but as an attempt to improve an aspect of their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a legitimate thing you have to balance when you look at all these kind of technologies. You know, there's always going to be the bad things you can do with technology and the good. And it's easy to talk about the bad and think about the bad, but what about that kind of a scenario? I mean, would you be willing to do that? I mean, I live in New York. At 9/11, so many people talked about, wow, what if we had had more ways to track people? Would that have made a difference in trying to find people and help people? So, you know, you have to think that positive set of scenarios through too, and not just assume, you know, it's somebody who's going to try to spy on you or find out where you are and do something wrong.
Yeah, I just want to end this discussion saying that if I had an RFID badge when I was in high school, I probably would not have spent so many hours inside of my locker. All right. Let's move on to, is Microsoft now good enough to compete with VMware? We've kind of hinted at the story. I want to get it out there because VMware, let's acknowledge it. They are the big boys when we're talking about virtual infrastructure. Their software is everywhere. It works really, really well. But recently, we've seen Microsoft make gains. I don't think anyone is saying Microsoft offers a better product overall. But enough people are saying, look, it's good enough. I know how it's going to perform. And for what I do, it's the solution that I'm going to use. I want to start with Chibert because you are the acknowledged master of virtual infrastructure here. What do you think? Are we at the point where Microsoft can sort of trumpet its own accolades here and say, yeah, we're ready for prime time. You could run your entire virtualized infrastructure on our solution.
Actually, there's quite a few people that I've met that are finally out of the experimentation stage, and they've decided that Hyper-V is good enough. And especially if you're, say, a university and you really have to watch every penny, Hyper-V is still considerably cheaper, especially when you start getting into the volume licenses. One of the things that really struck me when I was at the last Microsoft Reviewers Workshop was the fact that even though Microsoft isn't making a big deal about it, they actually have the equivalent of Zen App and Zen Desktop. And in addition, with Windows 8, they now have a Type 1 client hypervisor. Very big deal and considerably a pretty big impact on how people do things. Because, you know, Zen App and Zen Desktop have been absolutely wonderful. But man, does it get expensive after a while, especially when you start getting into large amounts of users, having to go through gateways and trying to maintain things like HIPAA or FERPA or what have you.
Curtis, what do you think about this? A while back, over the summer, people were sort of up in arms at VMware's change to a RAM-based licensing. And I think many experts were saying this was sort of a way to head off people who were taking Microsoft and running it inside of a VM in order to get around the licensing agreements for VM. In other words, get the advantages of VMware, but sort of the stock gravy features of Microsoft. They've dropped that. They've gotten rid of it. Is that an acknowledgement by VMware that, look, they're good enough where if you put impediments into users using it the way they want to, they'll just go to another solution?
I think that there is some of that. I think it's also an acknowledgement by VMware that there is a limit to just how complicated enterprise customers are willing to let licensing agreements be. I mean, the process of managing licenses has become an art form in and of itself. And what we're seeing already is that for some classes of products, the terms of the licenses and the ability to manage those licenses is as important as the strength of the technology behind the product. So I think that what we see here is VMware saying, you know what, we tried something, we got pushback from critical customers. We're going back to the old way because we'd rather sell as many of these as many licenses as we can rather than shut down as many Microsoft licenses as we can.
Mary Jo, I want to give you the last word on this, and that is looking at the announcements that Microsoft has made over the past few months and being so closely within the Microsoft sphere. What do you see as the key advantages of Microsoft's VM solutions over, say, VMware?
I actually don't think I'm probably the best person on this panel to answer that because I'm not as much of an expert as Chibert and some of the others here on that. But I can tell you, some of the people at ZDNet who've been reviewing VMware versus Hyper-V ever since the two started going head-to-head, when Microsoft came out with Windows Server 2012 and they started talking up all the new Hyper-V capabilities that were built in basically for free because it's included as part of the product, they were saying, finally, Microsoft is starting to address some of the holes that the VMware folks always said that they had and made people not willing to switch. And there's just a, there's like a huge laundry list of things that they added to Hyper-V version 3, which is what's in Windows Server 2012, from the clustering to Hyper-V replica. What else? Volume shadow copy, now supporting SMB file shares. I mean, there's just so many things. We could do a whole show just on every new feature of Hyper-V, pretty much. So, there are a lot of people who say Microsoft's finally making Hyper-V competitive enough to VMware where they actually think this is a trade-off, you know, like a worthwhile trade-off. And they said, okay, they don't have every single thing that that VMware has, but they have a lot of things and they're giving away a lot of things for a much lower price, if not free, to make it worth somebody doing the switch. So I think they are finally coming to the point where people who are looking at them on a head-to-head basis are saying, okay, Microsoft's really in the game here and it's time to get serious and look at Hyper-V now.
I think that's the general consensus, and that is that Microsoft, again, no one's going to say that it's absolutely 100% better than VMware's offerings, but it does it at a price point that is very attractive, and it does it within a solution that is very integrated. A lot of people are saying, if I'm already going to buy Microsoft Server to put inside of a VM, why wouldn't I just use VM? Chibert, I feel a disturbance in the force here. Did you want to have a last bit of a word here?
No, just that, you know, a lot of people need to go and take a look at how Microsoft has changed their licensing, especially for things like System Center. There's an awful lot of really cool things that are in Hyper-V, and I'm very, very excited about it. And the whole bit about, gee, is VMware better than Hyper-V? Well, just try it for yourself. You can try things very easily using demo licenses, and now with Server 2012, a lot of this is just single click, single or double clips. It's a role, server role. It's a lot easier to do, and you might be surprised at how well it works.
Well, okay, so that's Hyper-V, that's Microsoft. Well, let's see how it shakes out. I want to take a moment to thank another one of our sponsors, that's SAP, and their social media solutions services. These days, if you're running an enterprise, if you're running anything from a regional to national to international enterprise, you need to know what's going on with your brand. And what determines your brand is what's happening in social media. It's all about what the blogger is saying about your latest release, or what someone has put on her Facebook page or his Twitter feed. All of these bits of data form the basis, the consensus of what brands will succeed and what brands will fail. And if you are in charge of the social media presence for an enterprise, it's a daunting task, not just because of the sheer amount of data coming at you, but because it has to be intelligently analyzed. It has to be routed. It has to be sent off to the proper people who can do with that information what they need to do to defend your brand or to increase the public's perception of what it is that you do. And that's why we're taking a look at social media solutions from SAP. Their solution is divided into two parts. It starts with the listening component, which searches the social web in a smart way to know what is being said about your brand. It captures and reports on conversations about relevant terms, passions, patterns, even your competitors. It surfaces sentiment and the intensity of that sentiment. For example, it'll let you know if your customers like, love, or dislike something that you're doing. It also helps you build better products by incorporating real-time customer feedback into your innovation efforts. It helps you identify customers who are ready to buy. This is one of the things that blows me away. It can look at people's social media feeds and figure out if they're at that point and that they're going to pull the trigger. And it lets you know that that's the time to really push your message. The second part, well, it's the engaging component. This allows you to improve customer support by letting you set the rules about which messages, about which media, about which tweets and Facebook posts go to whom, and it determines how they should be dealt with. For example, if someone were to tweet a technical support problem, you can automatically route it to an engineer who can fix their problem through social media, giving you that warm, fuzzy feeling of knowing that your customers are being listened to. Also, social media solutions from SAP gives you an accurate and real-time understanding of your brand's social media performance, something that is almost impossible to actually qualify. SAP lets you do it at a click. If you manage the social media presence for a large regional or national enterprise, you need to get in touch with SAP. Find out more at sap.com/twit, and we thank SAP for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to the meat of the episode, and that is our Windows 8 extravaganza. There's so much that can be said about Windows 8. There's been so much rumor and conjecture over the last couple of weeks, everything from Sinofsky's departure to these rumors that Microsoft hasn't made their own sales targets. I want to hand this over to our acknowledged Windows expert, Mary Jo Foley. Mary Jo, what can you tell me about Windows 8? People are saying it's a bomb. People are saying it's not performing even as well as Microsoft thought it was going to perform. People are saying it's just too confusing. Where are we right now in terms of Windows 8 is Vista or Windows 8 is more like 7?
I'm in neither camp, actually, between those two things. I don't think this is going to be Vista. I also don't think this is going to be Windows 7. And what's surprising to me, I guess it shouldn't be that surprising, but it's surprising to me that now all these, you know, UX experts and people who haven't really been following along with Windows 8 are coming out with reviews like, wow, this is really different. Did you guys know this was different? Do you know there are tiles on this thing? It's just kind of funny to see it because we cover it so closely and to see all the surprised reaction from people. On Windows Weekly, I can tell you every episode we talked about Windows 8 for the past year plus, I've said on those episodes, enterprises aren't going to love this thing. It's going to take a lot of retraining. And there are not a lot of Metro-style apps, so, you know, people who care about that are not going to really love it also. And it's just funny to see all the people now jumping on this and saying, it's a failure. It's a flop. No, it's actually what we all knew it was going to be, which is a Microsoft trying to turn and pivot and come up with an operating system that works on mobile devices. My biggest criticism of Windows 8 all along has been, I think it's a really interesting and good user interface for touch tablets. I am not putting it on my Windows 7 PC. I want it nowhere near my Windows 7 PC, which is not a touch-enabled laptop, because that PC works just fine as it is. And I bet there are a lot of people who are business users of all sizes who are in my camp that when they get a new PC, it's going to come with Windows 8. They're going to learn it then. But right now, they're okay with the Windows 7 PC that they have.
I love what you're saying about this being it's a hard pivot for Microsoft. They realized that they needed to do something if they're going to compete with the surge of BYOD devices, of tablets and mobile devices. But there was an article from Larry Magid in which he was basically arguing that it's a tablet OS that's trying to be crammed onto a desktop, or maybe it was a desktop OS that they're trying to fit onto a tablet. And that's why he thinks it's so confusing. That's why he thinks people just don't understand what they're doing with Windows 8. But here in the studio, I've actually got a couple of Windows 8 devices. This one is this is a nice little 27-inch desktop all-in-one from Acer. Now, at first, I have to say, look, I wasn't the biggest fan of, and I'm still going to call it Metro. I don't care what Microsoft is calling. I wasn't a big fan of the Metro interface of Tiles, but I have found it to be responsive, and I found it to be very intuitive. I was able to put this in front of my three-year-old niece, and she went to town on it, just like she did on an iPad. And then, you know, of course, it has the desktop setting, which does let me use it the same way that I use Windows 7. And the functionality just seems to be so nice. This happens to be an Acer Aspire 7600U, which I'm demoing. Hopefully you'll see this one before you buy and not too long. But there's a whole class of devices that when Windows 8 is installed on it fresh, on a device that was actually designed for Windows 8, it works really, really well. Chibert, looking at this, looking at something like this, which, you know, I think makes sense for the consumer market, what do you think about using these kind of devices in enterprise?
Well, here's an example. This is actually a display link monitor. It's completely run from the USB, and it is a touchscreen. This one I'm actually going to be embedding with a ThinLinks client, and the plan is it's going to become a door sign so that when you go up to a classroom, you can actually go and find out what the schedule is for that classroom. You can go and find out whether or not a class has been moved and so forth. There's been a lot of demand for things like this from architects on trying to make the workspaces a lot smarter. I think there's going to be a lot of things showing up in the enterprise as far as digital signage, with Windows 8 because it works better on Windows 8. And Windows 8 has some toolkits available that just aren't there in Windows 7 in quite the form that you might want. So things like building directories. We're going to start seeing it in specialized vertical markets. And then it's going to, I think it's going to slowly move around as more touch devices become available.
Curtis, enterprise has always been the bread and butter of Microsoft. When we talk about the installed user base, a huge percentage of that is in offices. It's in enterprises. It's on networks. Now we're seeing devices, again, like this Windows 8 computer, and even like this. This is a Windows 8 notebook that I also have from Acer, which is nice because just like the desktop, it's also touch-enabled. It's a new class of products that are selling for a premium, and they're integrating so many things that we've expected from our other consumer devices. This big desktop actually has the Kinect sensor built into it, so you know, with a wave of my hand, I can switch back and forth between Windows. What do you think about them building for a consumer base and then hoping it trickles into the enterprise rather than building for the enterprise base and then watching it trickle into the consumers?
Well, that's something that we've been watching for the past 2 or 3 years. The entire BYOD movement comes from this concept that in many cases, the technology available for consumers is more advanced than the client technology that enterprises are using. Enterprises have a class of problem that consumers don't, training and support being the two biggest. It's not just a case of, will you take the time to spend a weekend learning how to use the Metro interface, but what's it going to cost to teach 5,000 users to effectively use the Metro interface? I think that the enterprise is going to be slow to adopt Windows 8. I think that it's going to primarily come into the enterprise in the guise of smartphones and tablets. Frankly, I think that the place that we're likely to see it specified most readily within the enterprise is on tablets. We'll probably see those starting to replace a reliance on iOS-based tablets sometime in the next 6 to 12 months. As for the rest of it, I think that Windows 8 is going to have a long, slow, gradual uptake into the enterprise. Ultimately, will it get there? Probably. But I think that we are likely to be having a conversation in 2015, 2016 about how many companies are still holding on to the older interface rather than having embraced Metro as the way that all their employees are working.
Mary Jo, what do you think about that? I mean, the training to use the Metro interface seems to be one of these common misunderstood factors. It sounds like Microsoft's betting that people are just going to take to this. I mean, oh, if you can use an iPad, you should be able to use this. If you've got a Windows phone, you should be able to use this. And so naturally, you're going to want it in the enterprise. Do you think it's going to make that jump, or is this an uphill struggle?
Yeah, I think it's going to be an uphill struggle for sure. And I had an iPad recently. I got rid of my iPad when I bought my Surface RT because I didn't need both devices. But I found the iPad way, way more intuitive and quick to learn than Windows 8. I know a lot of people say, hey, it's just the start menu that's different and nothing else is different. There are a lot of things that are different. The swiping, the charms. I think Microsoft could have made this more palatable to business users if they had done things like allow business users to boot straight to the desktop. Instead, they made it so users couldn't do that. They made it so the start button goes away for everyone. There's no way to bring it back unless you use a third-party program like Stardock, Stardate, or the classic shell. So, you know, they made some very conscious decisions, basically saying to users, you're going to either learn this or you're not going to use it. And I think that a lot of customers will say just what they said with Windows XP. Hey, it's good enough, and I'm going to stick with what's good enough. And in this case, it may be Windows 7.
Let's talk quickly about that because it seems like such a small thing, and yet I've heard more about that particular item than anything else, and that is the start button. You know, looking at my desktop here, if you reduce everything, it really does look like the Windows 7 desktop. You've got your little start bar, you've got your icons, but it's missing the start button. And so many people have said, wait a minute, you know, why couldn't you give me that start button so that I could switch to the desktop and be able to use Windows like I'm accustomed to using it? Mary Jo, why is it you think they took away the start button?
I think they believe that users weren't really using it that way. They always talk about all the telemetry data that they gather about customer use patterns. And they said, you know, it's not being used the way we wanted it or expected it to be used. And so we're going to redo the whole start menu with the way they did with the start screen instead. And, you know, they've got all this telemetry data showing people like to pin icons. This is what they prefer to do and how they prefer to get at their applications. You know, it's hard to say everybody likes to do it this way or everyone doesn't when you have 1.2 billion users, which I think is what they're up to with Windows now. There's always people who are outliers. There are always people who say, no, I don't want to do it that way. I don't like it that way. So it's hard to do something that everybody's going to like or even the majority of people are going to like necessarily. But I think it was probably a combination of this idea that this isn't how users interact or how they should or would if on a touch-centric, touch-first device. And also probably design aesthetics, too. I mean, they paid a lot of attention to design when they built Windows 8 and Windows RT, and they just didn't feel the start button fit in with that design either.
Curtis, I want to bring out a conspiracy theory to you. I read an article over the weekend from a tech writer who was saying that we are seeing devices like this, Acer Aspire 7600U or this Acer S7 Ultrabook. And they've all got Windows 8 bundled on them, and you cannot get the features that are integrated within these products on Windows 7 devices, and that's by design. For example, this has the Kinect sensor built into it, so I can play Kinect games on my Windows 8 PC. I can mount this on my wall. It's got HDMI in, so I can use it as the center of my entertainment system. We're not going to see that on Windows 7 PCs because it's a sort of a subtle way for Microsoft to say, if you want those features, you need to use 8. Do you put any stock in that, or that's just the nature of the game? Newer hardware gets more features.
Well, I don't think that it's a Microsoft conspiracy. And to the extent that, yes, the hardware companies and Microsoft want consumers to buy new products, then it's a conspiracy of the entire industry. But it's the way things have been done for the last, 30 years or so. I think that if you asked someone from Acer or Lenovo or Dell or one of the other hardware vendors, that they would likely tell you that they are putting these hardware features bundled with the operating system that lets you use them most readily. They would describe this as a feature rather than a bug. I do think that they are all hoping that these new features, taken together, the hardware and the software, will drive a lot of people to buy new systems. Now, whether that's true or not is what's going to decide whether this is called a success over the course of the next quarter. I think calling it a success over the course of the next 3 or 4 years is going to be a much different thing.
Cheebert, I want to bring to you an element that's been brought up in the chat room several times and something that it does concern me, and that's the UEFI. It's the secure boot option on new Windows 8 PCs. These PCs can now be locked down in BIOS, so they will only run Windows 8. You can't run an open source alternative. You won't be putting Ubuntu on this thing. What do you think about that? A lot of people are crying foul. But then you've got that sort of the other side, which is saying, wait a minute, Apple hardware has been locked down forever, and you know they're just trying to provide a good experience. Is this Microsoft asking the same of its manufacturers? Give us hardware that will only run the software that we know runs well.
Well, you got to keep in mind one of the big successes that Apple has had is because their hardware has been locked down, the developers have a more consistent platform to develop on. A consistent platform means better software because you don't have to write for this, that, and the other thing, Joe's white box PC. Now, I tell to the people that are complaining about UEFI is that vote with your dollars. If you go and say, I'm not going to stand for that and I'm not going to buy these boxes, you're going to watch UEFI die very, very quickly. It's all about follow the money.
Mary Jo, what about that? Follow the money? Is this something that if enough people don't buy the hardware that's UEFI enabled, that manufacturers will change their tune? Or is this the future? I mean, is it going to be, if you want to put an open source alternative onto your hardware, you're going to have to buy hardware that's specifically, well, open, or you're going to have to build your own?
Yeah, I'm kind of hazy on this because I haven't written about this in a while. I know that it's not what a lot of people are making this out to be, that it's not trying to restrict people from putting Linux on their machines. And it's more of a security thing, basically. And, you know, the I think it was the Software Freedom Foundation. They've posted publicly that they're working on something that will allow people to boot Linux on their Windows 8 machines. So I think this is something that it sounds like a great conspiracy theory topic and something that, like, oh, Microsoft's trying to keep Linux off the machines. I think it's more a case of Microsoft trying to do something to make machines more secure, and they're not going to block you from loading what you want on these machines. There's going to be a way to do this. And sorry, I'm not as up to speed on this one because I haven't written about it recently. Like I said, I kind of put it on the back burner of the conspiracy theory Microsoft stories that I keep over here and I don't always look into all the time.
Let's get into a little bit of something that Paul Theroux wrote, and he's of our own Windows Weekly with Mary Jo and Leo Laporte. And he was arguing that, look, an OS isn't sexy, that Microsoft's being very confusing between Windows RT and Surface RT and Surface Pro and Windows 8. Are we seeing a mixed message still, you know, even with the departure of Sanofsky, even with the pledge for our unified UI? Are we still getting Microsoft sending mixed signals to both consumers and enterprise that, yeah, we've got a bunch of different SKUs and we don't plan on making those go away at any given time? Mary Jo, I want to tap you first because you seem to be following this a whole lot closer than the rest of us.
So, yeah, you know, you're talking about what Paul said about how well or isn't it selling and why.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, Paul said on Windows Weekly a couple weeks ago, he had heard from one of his close sources that it wasn't selling up to the projections, the internal projections that Microsoft had. So we don't know what those projections are so far. They haven't released any real sales data beyond saying there were 4 million upgrades in the first 3 days. So that didn't include copies of Windows 8 sold on OEM hardware. So that's the only number we have for sure right now. You know, I have to say, when I've looked at what's out there with Windows 8 on it at this point, which is about a month after the launch, I'm kind of not wowed. And this reminds me so much of Windows 7. When the product started to sell and you went into stores and started kicking the tires on what was out there, there just wasn't a whole lot out there at the beginning. And it was really disappointing. And you were like, wow, didn't OEMs have enough time? Like, there have been, you know, with Windows 8, there have been some really crazy form factors, like the Tai Chi, that dual screen thing, the yoga pad. There are all these things, and you look at them, and you go, okay. Their OEMs are trying some different stuff, but nothing has screamed out to me like, wow, I want that machine. I'm ready to upgrade. I'll even take on Windows 8 because this hardware is so amazing. The only thing I've even seen that made me excited at all was the Surface. And I bought the Surface RT, and I've actually been pretty happy with it. I think because I knew what I was buying and I knew what I was going to get. I knew what the limitations were. So I don't know. I feel like maybe the sales haven't been as good, or maybe they have. I don't really know. But I got to tell you, until the OEMs come out with some better hardware, I don't think you're going to see a lot of really engaged customers out there. And that said, I know there are people who really like certain things. Like, I've seen people say, I want the Iconia, I want the Tai Chi, I want the IdeaPad. I just am speaking mostly for myself. I just don't see a lot of hardware out there that makes me say, I've got to go get this now.
Now, I want to throw this to you, Curtis. I really like playing with these devices. I find them to be a lot of fun. But again, I'm using it as a consumer. I think it sounds like all of us are in consensus that there's not a lot here that is really telling us that we need to use this inside of the enterprise, that it has to be deployed, that people have to be trained, that there's no killer function on Windows 8 yet that tells me that I need to replace my current installed base of workstations. What would have to be true about Windows 8? What would they have to change? What would have to develop in order for this to be the next standard for enterprise computing?
Well, I think that what we're looking at is things from a number of different angles. One, there is practically nothing in Windows 8 that's going to lead users to go to the IT department, pitchforks and torches in hand, and demand that all of the Windows XP, Windows Vista, Windows 7 devices be thrown out so that Windows 8 can be put in front of all the users. I don't think that IT would tend to care even if they did show up with pitchforks. What Windows 8 needs to do for the enterprise to really take it on is a continuation of what they've already done a lot of, and that's integrate its management capabilities with what can be done with Windows Server 2012. And they really have made a fair number of behind-the-scenes changes to make it much easier for someone to bring a Windows 8 device into the network and have it managed, even if they're bringing in a Windows 8 device that they get for Christmas, that they bought on their own dime, that they got while they were in college but want to bring into the enterprise when they get their first real job. They can do that and have IT be much happier about it because of the management capabilities than they would be with one of the earlier operating systems. I also think it's amazing the degree to which we have become blasé. We all, and I put myself in this category, are now judging an operating system not on is it stable, does it let us get work done, but does it really blow us away? Does this bring the age of the Jetsons to us? The bar that a new product, whether it be a hardware product or an operating system, has to clear to be really something that we get excited about has gotten exceptionally high. And I'm not sure that it's realistic for any product at this point. Unless Windows 8 came out, sucked itself onto our face, ran probes into our ears, and just ran off our thoughts alone, I'm not sure that it was ever going to have the kind of wow factor that a lot of people were demanding.
All right. One last go around. I want to get each of my my panelists here, starting with you, Chibert. Windows 8, is it going to be adopted into the enterprise, or are we waiting for the next version? Are we waiting for the odd number before enterprise actually starts adopting this?
Actually, I think Windows 8 is going to be a slow burn. It's going to be the operating system that gets replaced when you update your hardware. I personally think Microsoft, especially now that Sinofsky's gone, we might actually see, I hope, the start button come back. The original thing that I saw way, way, way back when they started talking Windows 8 for the first time is they're saying, well, it's going to be optional. You could have a regular Windows 7 desktop, or you could have the new Metro GUI, and you can choose between the two. That just didn't quite happen as they said. So I keep hoping that maybe they'll see the light that the consumers are voting with their dollars.
Curtis, what about you? Enterprise is going to take Windows 8. Is it going to be that slow burn you talked about? Or are they just going to skip it and wait? Even though Windows 8 is a perfectly good OS, they're going to wait for the refinements in Windows 9.
I think some of that depends on just how quickly Microsoft brings out Windows 9. Windows 7 is an awfully good operating system. It's stable, it's powerful, it's manageable. It does most of what an enterprise needs to have done on their client devices. The companies that had just started going to Windows 7 or have just completed a migration to Windows 7, it's going to be 2 to 5 years before they're ready to look at making a significant change. We'll have to see if Windows 8 is still around by then or if we've gone to a Windows 9. I think the timing is going to matter a great deal.
Mary Jo, you get the last word, of course, that's appropriate. Would Windows 8 have been a stellar success if it had come after Vista? I mean, is Windows 7 just too good of an OS for Windows 8 to get that quick adoption? And are we going to be waiting for Windows 9 in the enterprise?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a big factor. Windows 7 was and is a really good operating system, and enterprises are in the midst of moving to it. And a lot of enterprise users I talk to say their strategy is they always skip one release of Windows. So if they're upgrading to 7 now, they didn't even have in their plan to go to 8 at all, and they're thinking about 9. But one interesting new tidbit to add to this conversation is there is supposedly another version of Windows between Windows 8 and Windows 9 that's on the books. It's codenamed Blue. It's supposed to be out next summer if they stick to the schedule. And now that we know that that's on the timeline, or at least it has been on the timeline, a lot of people are hoping that this is where Microsoft might kind of step back a little bit and say, okay, let's let users boot to the desktop directly if they want to in Blue. Some people have said maybe they'll add the start button back as an option in Blue. I don't know if either of these things will happen, and I'm not advocating for them to happen. But there is this thing supposedly that's coming in between, and it's supposed to be more than just a service pack. It's supposed to have some new features and new functionality. So that's kind of the wild card here, and maybe Microsoft will have something up their sleeves to make Windows 8 more appealing to a bigger number of users in that release.
Windows Blue, now with Windows the start Blue. Button. I want to take a moment to thank our last sponsor, RingCentral. When we built the Brick House, we decided that we wanted to do as much as possible in the cloud. We didn't want a clunky old PBX system. We didn't want hardware cluttering up the basement. We didn't want proprietary desktop phones everywhere. And so when Russell, our IT guy, came to us and told us that we could get a professional quality PBX system in the cloud with no management within the Brick House, of course, we jumped on it. It works exactly like you would expect a cloud system to work. We love RingCentral. There are zero startup costs. There's no hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to customize all of our call handling. Our producers can get their voicemail in their email. We can get our fax messages on our phones. We can control everything from a simple user interface. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing, which is nice if you've ever had to install a phone system. And they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free for up to 20 phones. So call this number, which has been designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I want to thank my panel for, there was a lot discussed today. I had a blast. Let's start with you, Cheever. What do you got going on? What do you want the TWIT listeners to know about? What new tech, new projects, new cool stuff's going on with the Geek in Paradise?
Actually, one of the things is I'm making a prediction. There's a technology called a digital fountain. It makes use of things called Aloha channels. You basically take data, you chop it up into lots of little pieces, you transmit it. If you've got a reliable connection, it purposely drops out channels and recreates them mathematically at the far end. James Cameron used it on Avatar for moving the dailies around, but it is now owned by Qualcomm. Gee, I wonder if we're going to start seeing this in future Snapdragons. Ought to be interesting.
Curtis, what about you? What's going on with enterprise efficiency? Actually, I hear you're going to have an interesting episode next week.
We are indeed. We're going to be looking at the gadgets that make the lives of CIOs easier, and we're going to have a familiar guest. The beloved Padre SJ is going to be a guest, and we're hoping that Cheebert's going to be able to join us from Hawaii. It should be a familiar group. Check enterpriseefficiency.com for times and dates. And would like to ask the TWIT universe, if you have gadgets or services that make your life easier, let me know about them. Drop me a note either to my Twitter handle, which is down here, KG4GWA, or franklin@enterpriseefficiency.com for an email.
Mary Jo, it's always wonderful to have you on. In fact, I think having you on the show is better than making bacon pancakes. It's one of these these rare opportunities that we get to have a true maven of tech. And what's going on? What projects do you want our audience to know about?
So I'm actually going to be out in California next week, which is unusual because I usually am between here and Seattle, kind of jetting back and forth. But I'm going to be on the .NET Rocks road trip next week. So .NET Rocks is another podcast, Richard Campbell and Carl Franklin, that the Microsoft universe knows a lot about. And they're taking their RV on the road, and they're going to Sunnyvale next week to Microsoft Research down there. And I'm going to be their live guest on December 4th. So if you go to the .NET Rocks website, you can register. It's free, and you can come and watch the show live that we're going to be taping there. And before that, of course, Windows Weekly on Thursday this week. We'll have another great show as usual. Lots to talk about with everybody buying all their new Surfaces and Windows phones. So that should be a good one, too.
Thanks to all of my panelists. It's wonderful that you come every week and just join me for some enterprise geekiness. Now, as for you, you listeners, you watchers, my audience, my Twiet faithful, did you know that you could subscribe to the podcast? That's right. You could have it delivered directly into whatever device you want each and every single week. If you go to our page at twit.tv/Twiet, you can find all the different ways that you can subscribe. iTunes, sure. RSS feed, of course. Get it delivered to your iPhone, to your iPod, to your Android device, your Android phone, your tablet, whatever it may be. We want to make it easy for you to catch every single episode of Twiet Goodness. Also, why don't you join us for our Twiet Q&A episode? That's right. We're going to be taking your questions and giving you answers live on the air. If you go to twiet.reddit.com, you can suggest questions for the show and vote up or down the existing questions. We're going to be taking the best questions in the next week, so get your submissions in now. Cheever and I have been going over some of the submissions, and there are some great questions in there that should lead to good discussion. Also, you can follow me on Twitter. If you go to twitter.com/PadreSJ, you'll be able to find out what we're doing on every single episode, who our guests are, and, more importantly, you'll be able to suggest topics for future episodes of Twiet. So join me there just to follow what the Digital Jesuit's doing in the real world. Also, Cheever, did you know that, we do this show live?
Live?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. We do it in real life. Every Monday at noon at live.twit.tv, you can join us. You can see how the sausage is made. You can see the pre-show and the post-show. And if you join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, you can meet some of the personalities that will drive the behind-the-scenes brain that is Twiet. In fact, we've got some of the most brilliant people, some of the biggest trolls, and just all around the coolest temporary community that you can find on the interwebs. That's it for this episode of Twiet. Thanks for spending an hour with us. Again, thanks to our panelists. Thanks to my fantastic TD, Jason, who always pulls rabbits out of his hat to make everything run smoothly. Thanks to my super producer, Karsten. And thanks to you for dropping by. I'm Father Robert. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiet.